Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Driven Chat podcast. You're listening to the voice of John Markar. That's me, hello. And sat beside me in our convertible lorry radio slash podcast slash TV studio truck parked outside our favourite automotive venue in the world, Caffeine and Machine. I'm also joined by Amy Shaw.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm well, are you?
Good, I'm well, thank you. It was a very elaborate description of the truck.
It was, wasn't it? Maybe a bit over elaborate.
No, it's painted a good picture. I like it.
I'm glad. I do wonder, for those that haven't seen our social media feeds, what they imagine our truck looks like, because we do talk about it a lot, but we don't often give a lot of behind-the-scenes tours of it and things.
Maybe do a drawing and then post it onto social media of what you think the truck is. It's like when kids like do the drawing of, you ever tried to draw a bicycle from memory?
That I know.
Hardest thing.
Yeah, or a horse. So yeah, as Amy suggests, draw a picture of what you think our truck looks like. Take a photo, tag us on social media and just write somewhere, "I think your truck looks like this." And we'll judge them. And the best one gets a hat.
I like the prize. If you need any more encouragement. Yeah.
If you want a hat, then draw a picture of our truck. Now, far more interesting than drawing pictures of trucks. Today we are bringing you, as we always do, a special guest. And this week's special guest might just make you some money. Now, one thing that I'm going to say to start with is, because this is a proper conversation that involves conversations about investments and things, we have to be very careful about how we say things, the way that we say things. So some answers might be a little fluffy, but that's because we have to be very careful with regulations and things. But let me introduce you to the voice of David Spickett, who is the owner of a company called The Car Crowd. Hello.
Hi, great to be here. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. Really good, thank you. Yeah.
Awesome. Right. Now, I could do my best in trying to give an overview of what your company is, but seeing as it's your company, I think you're going to do a slightly better job. So I'm going to let you, David, if it's okay, just give us a quick overview of what on earth The Car Crowd is.
Okay, thanks. I mean, a quick intro then. So The Car Crowd gives a way for petrolheads everywhere to buy a real equity share in classic cars and then benefit from any future appreciation. So essentially, that means people, like-minded people, can club together to buy the car of their dreams. The platform deals with all of the regulatory paperwork and the legal side of it. They get a real, as I say, equity share in that classic car. We also store it, insure it and maintain it. So they're kind of, I guess, free to really reap the benefits of classic car investment without having to have the space or the capital to buy the whole thing.
Gotcha. Now, I'm going to address the big
elephant in the room, which is the one that kind of cropped up when I first heard about the company and we had a little chat before we started recording. And that is, and this is going to make a few people go, huh? But I'm going to say it because it needs to be mentioned. You're investing in the car, in a car,
yep.
But you, as the investor, don't actually have any access to the car.
Well, access, yes. Mm-hmm. To be able to drive it, no. Yeah. I mean, the platform actually caters for people who are in groups of two people, if you like, up to millions of people potentially. Mm. So the cars that we bring to the platform ourselves, we divide those into 1,000 shares, and those actually aren't able to be driven because they're just appreciation, or sorry, they're stored to try and maximize appreciation. Yep. So if we were to let people drive them like a timeshare concept, for example, that would obviously have lots of different people in the car, lots of different journeys, destinations, mileage, and that would unfortunately depreciate the car with wear and tear. So because we're looking to give maximum return on investment, we don't let people drive them. However, from an access perspective, we do lots of cars and coffee events. Mm-hmm. We also have a 8,000 square foot storage unit up in Nottinghamshire that we're opening up to the general public. So come and join us for a coffee, look at the cars, sit in the cars and sort of experience them that way, but just not the sort of open road driving aspect of it.
Gotcha.
However, if there was a group of people that wanted to, say, fund a track car and they did want to drive the car, they could come to us and still use the platform in the same way. We'd do the regulatory paperwork, but they would then be able to store, maintain, insure and drive their own car. They would just have a legal, if you like, way of co-owning that vehicle.
Gotcha. So I have no doubt, as I initially did, I'll be honest, there will be people at home going, well, what's the point? I don't get it. Because they're all car people.
Yeah.
And a lot of car people, the minute you say, hey, here's the opportunity to own a share of a Spyker.
Yeah.
Let's say, for example, there'll be people going, oh, yeah, that sounds great. I'd love to own a share of a Spyker. I've never driven one of those before.
Yeah, absolutely.
But of course, this is a platform where you are ultimately investing in a car as if you would be investing in a company.
Exactly
right.
You're
not, you haven't got ownership of the company. You can't unfortunately turn up on a Monday morning and be director for the day just because you've got
although
six
some
shares.
Companies might be way better if you did do that. No, you're absolutely right. There is a natural tendency or desire to want to drive the car, absolutely. Yeah. But the way I think about it is, people at the moment invest in companies. Some people invest in Bitcoin, for example, knowing very little about what that company does, having very little control about what that company does on a day-to-day basis. Yet there are people out there that know everything there is to know about fast Fords or classic Ferraris or something. And unless they've got the money to buy that whole car, store and insure it, they can't get access to the appreciation that potentially that car could realise them.
Yeah.
So we wanted to find a way of actually making it, unlocking it, if you like, for everybody. Mm. And saying, you don't have to be a millionaire to have your own classic car collection anymore. You can actually be a modest person and have a few hundred pounds in, say, 4 or 5 different cars, feel like it's your own classic car collection in terms of access to the vehicles and looking at them, and also benefiting from the future appreciation or potential appreciation of the cars as well. And it's just, I guess, it is something that people are more knowledgeable about. Therefore, it's actually a more considered choice for them. If they don't, unlike a fund as well, you get to choose which car you invest in with us. It's if you like that car and you think it's a great car, invest in that one. Mm. If you don't, then don't. You're not trusting somebody else with your money to buy lots of cars on your behalf. It's actually, individually, you get the choice. And obviously, as I say, because people tend to be very passionate about certain brands or certain types of cars, they're actually going in with an open mind and more knowledge of that individual investment.
So does it work like, do you say to people, we have got this car that you can buy shares into, or does somebody come to you and say, I would like to buy shares in this car, go and find me one?
A combination of the both, really. I mean, at the moment, we're trying to offer, as we're growing, obviously, and trying to get more of a reputation, so we're trying to offer cars onto the platform. So we're sourcing vehicles from all around the country and trying to bring those. Got distracted.
We will get distracted a lot
distracted
of time sitting here.
the bourbon exhaust. So we're trying to bring cars onto the platform that we think might have a good spread and that people would be interested in. So we're sourcing those. We've got things like a little Renault 5 GT Turbo coming on really soon, right up to the Spyker that we mentioned, the C8, which is much more of a supercar type investable classic. So we're trying to bring different things that will appeal to different people. But then we've also been contacted recently by a guy who wanted him and 8 friends, they want to buy an Audi R8 together. So they've sourced their own car. They've got a manual R8. Right. They think it's going to go up in value. I agree with them. I think it's a great, great idea. We're going to sort all the paperwork out for them because our platform is scalable and we've done all of the economies of scale type stuff, it'd be cheaper than you individually going to a law firm and getting the contracts all drawn up. You can just use the platform to do it. So it's kind of versatile like that, really. If people come to us with cars or if we find them and we think it's a great opportunity, we'll bring it ourselves onto the platform.
It's an interesting one because we have previously had conversations both on the podcast and on radio shows with various people about making money from classic cars.
Yeah.
It's a great subject for, like you say, people that have a passion for cars and have a bit of spare cash. Often there is no better market than the market you know. So if you have got a passion for cars and you've got, let's say, £25,000-£30,000 to play with, then something like going out and buying a manual R8 might seem like a really sensible option because, of course, you could put that money into a stocks and shares ISA, but it goes into this ether that you know nothing about. It's gone. It's just, and you just sit there thinking, oh, I hope that works.
Yeah, and you can't impress your mates down the pub either with it, can you?
Exactly.
But yeah, no, absolutely. And
we've always remarked on the benefit of being able to invest in classic cars, purchasing cars that are appreciating assets and not having to pay things like capital gains tax, which is a great thing. Whether that will remain
the case
for years to come, I don't know, because I think at some point somebody's going to have to go, hang on a minute,
yes,
we could make money from this as well. What makes your platform is slightly different, because of course any of us here, anyone sat here at Cafe in the Machine right now, could go into their bank account, take out every penny they've got, buy a car and just hope that it goes up in value.
Sure.
And in that form of investing, you know, we don't have to jump through hoops of FCO and financial ombudsman and various other government regulated things that we have to be aware of.
Yeah.
Because that is just ultimately, we take the money out of the bank, we buy the thing and then hopefully we make some money from it.
Sure.
What you're doing is actually fully regulated, regimented, and it's a proper investment company, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we have to say we directly aren't regulated, so we are an appointed representative of a company called Kessian Capital Limited, who are regulated by the FCA directly.
Gotcha.
But what that means is we've got a license, if you like, for arranging deals and investments. That's what our appointed representative status means. So we're able to bring things to the platform that we think would be attractive to that audience. And that means they have to pass quite a strict criteria. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't just bring any car on that we want. And we were really passionate about making sure that we did come with you know, sort of a regulatory, I can't say regulatory backing, but with a bit of an assurance for the investors that this was a real company, you know, with following all of the relevant regulatory crowdfunding procedures that are out there, because we wanted people to feel safer, you know, than just investing something in you know, that could just disappear off into the ether and they never sort of see any returns. And that took us nearly a year to obtain. We've got to have the right business plan. We've got to make sure it's fair and it's transparent. It gives consumer confidence and it utilizes the structure around the limited company that just people are familiar with and they know. You know, we're not talking about sort of these non-fungible tokens that are out there now and starting to become a bit of a commodity, but a bit confusing. You know, it's buying a share in a limited company that owns that vehicle outright. So it's just like buying a sort of high street stock and share, really. So it's a known concept, which is what we wanted to do. But that does mean we have to follow the relevant regulatory procedures in order to be able to do it.
Gotcha. So that's the, you know, the official important bits and pieces out of the way.
Yeah,
isn't
I guess
it?
So. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
It's a tricky one. I wonder, and I know Amy, you had some questions about how this sort of activity might affect the market, because again, you know, the classic car market, and not necessarily even classic car, but even modern brand new hypercars. You know, there are people that come out and make money in 6 months of buying a brand new hypercar and not even driving it and making a whole load of cash on it, because some people just can't be bothered to wait.
Oh, absolutely. And we look at the Yaris GR now.
Exactly.
I mean, about £8,000 to jump the waiting list.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you just think it's only 30 something grand car in the first place, you know, and they're willing to pay 30-40% off again, just to jump the queue. So
I suppose that was one of my questions. When you're thinking about what cars you want to buy and you think to yourself, right, I think this is going to be a good investment for my shareholders, of people.
Sure.
Like, obviously, it's to be able to have that knowledge, you'd be very, very rich very quickly from any point. So how, like, what are the things that you think about before you think, okay, I think this is going to be the car, or, you know, what gives you an idea of thinking that's going to be something that's going to go up? Because as we've just said about, like, the Yaris's, until you're in the trend, you never know it's going to go up. So and by the time you're in the trend, is that too late to make the, you know, to have a successful payback of investment?
It's a great question. And it's the conversation, I think, that happens in pubs like up and down the country with petrolheads, isn't it? You know, what's going to be the next big car? And it is very usually heart driven.
Yeah.
You know, people are passionate about a certain brand or certain things. So one of the hardest things for us when we're looking at what type of cars to buy is to be head driven, you know, is to be more scientific, I guess, with the approach and a bit more logical, and take out that, you know, try to take away anyway, that passion and heart bit a little little bit. And we kind of use a criteria, like I said before. I mean, there's the basics, which I think you'd expect, which is, you know, has to be kind of a low mileage vehicle, has to have low owners. We look for obviously great provenance, so good service history, with non-imports, non-write-offs, you know, all the sort of stuff you'd look for basically when you were buying a normal car anyway. And then we also add on, you know, some things that kind of make it a bit interesting or quirky. So low edition numbers or numbered vehicles are always really good from an investment perspective. Something like the Clio V6, where it's just, you know, a crazy concept car that probably should never have almost been produced because they took that family shopping wagon that was the Clio and stuck a V6 engine in the back. You know, or for example, the E90 M3, top tip for everybody, E90 M3, the only V8 M3, you know, is going to look back on that in 10 or 15 years and everyone's going to go, God, that was the only V8 ever put into an M3. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, something that makes it a bit quirky or a bit special is a really good one. And then we look for, you know, general pedigree. So you have the manual rather than the Tiptronic. If it's a manual box car like a Ferrari or a Porsche, those sorts of things are quite, you know, tick boxy. There's things like 25 years with the America emissions test. So research whether or not the car was actually manufactured for the American market or not. If it wasn't, it can't be exported or imported, sorry, until it's 25 years old and becomes a classic car and therefore exempt for the emissions test. And that then opens up the whole of the North America market. So the Clio V6 is another good example of that, never made for America. I think there's only one in North America at the moment. So as soon as they hit 25 years old,
perfect.
I mean, they're already climbing at sort of 21, 22 years old. So, you know, they're going to go sort of through the roof, I think, in the next couple of years. And we've got one available for investment, which is why we chose that. And then, you know, so it's, and then the last part of it, I guess, is just this sort of double curve you get. You know, the people who were 17 years old and had posters of the Escort Cosworths on their wall, it's no surprise that 20 years later, those Escort Cosworths are now getting up to 100K because they don't make them anymore. But those people are still so passionate and love them that they've come into a bit of money in their late 30s and they're buying them up and they're changing hands for, you know, for sort of silly money. And then that kind of happens a little bit again when you hit retirement age and you know, you sort of, you know, release equity in your house or whatever and you want to have your last midlife crisis or whatever it is and get your last one. So, I mean, it's not, you know, I think anybody could do it. You know, it's not a, there's no real trick, if you like. It's all sort of common sense and science, you know, sort of scientific, if you like. But it's just having, you know, the knowledge and I guess the time and the patience to go through all those different checklists and criteria, make sure the car that comes out at the end of it is the right one. And then obviously you've got to have the capital to buy it. You've got to have the money to insure it and store it. And that's why, you know, we're hoping to bring these cars that are sound, if you like, in terms of their opportunity or potential to appreciate. But you don't have to have the 30K to buy a Clio. You have to have just £30 to buy one share.
Yeah.
And then you can still benefit from any future appreciation in it as well. So it's a great job. And I love it. You have to kiss a lot of frogs and you see quite a lot of really bad cars and notice how dishonest people can be when they describe their own cars.
Yep.
You know, see through rose tinted glasses. But you know, that's what I loved. I've always loved cars. It's been in my blood since I was about 4 years old and used to go down to Linden Hill scraping mud off of a Rallycross Metro. So, you know, it's always been there. And now it's become my job, if you like, or part of my job to source the cars. It's a fantastic, fantastic place to be.
Yeah, I'd love to know. I'd love to hear a few stories because there must be a few of these big old journeys to go and buy the car that's been advertised in a particular way.
Yeah.
Because we've all done it. We've all turned up to a car and gone.
It looked so good. It sounded so great. And then I even put a deposit down over the phone. I've paid money for it, went to go and see it. And I was like, this is not as you described. It's like, well, tough. You're not having your deposit back. Oh,
no.
I was not happy.
Oh, that's not fair.
Was this a Range Rover?
Range Rover, yes.
Range Rover Classic.
Yes, that was it. Yeah, it was just... let's say photographed from a slight distance, I'm guessing. And then, yeah, like I took my boyfriend and he was literally underneath the car. And within seconds, he was like, no way in hell are we having this.
Wow.
And yeah, no, it was, as you said, there must be so many great stories, as you said, of this was how it's described.
Oh, yeah.
This is what we
it's like with the estate agents, isn't it? Where they just, you know, sort of
fix her upper.
Yeah.
Great project.
Yeah. And I just, yeah, absolutely, loads. I mean, we're getting better. I mean, I think the big thing now is we do, and actually it's Rich from Appreciating Classics, one of the best, I think, you know, dealers for Appreciating Classics in the UK. We were talking about the Sunny that we've got out here, the Sunny GTIR, and he sort of taught me a trick, if you like, about what he wanted to see before he would even consider coming to look at the vehicle. And that's helped me, actually, because that's the sort of thing now that we do with some of the people that we're looking to buy off of. And, you know, it's getting videos of all the seals before you go and the engine bays and hearing it tick over, cold starts, all those sorts of things. And actually, what tends to happen now is if you ask for that stuff and they don't even respond,
yes,
you already know, okay, you know, it's probably not going to be worth my time to go for a trip. And we've got a bad story and a good story, I guess. The bad story being a Porsche GT3 we went to go look at. that was somewhere near Durham, and it was, you know, absolutely beautiful. It was a 60-something thousand pounds, and I thought that's, you know, that's a really good price for a GT3. Yeah. You know,
it's a
996. Yeah, absolutely, a 996. And it was only like 20-something thousand miles, full history. It looked really good, and it probably was about 10 grand too cheap. And you go there, and then it's, you know, as soon as I got there, I saw that the front wing and the bonnet were a completely different colour of blue.
Oh, no.
And then the rear wing on the back had just, you know, half fallen off. And you're just like, how can you not really? You know? Yeah. So that was a frustrating one. Whereas a good one, we're just about to go and pick up a Renault 5 GT Turbo Raider Edition. And the guy, I said, can I have a video of it? And he's done two cold start videos of him driving it, done a whole walk around thing, put it up on ramps, videoed the underneath, then starts putting out the documentation. And I kid you not, I think he sent me nearly 270 pictures single page of the documentation, including the brand new poster that you got given when you bought the Raider out of the showroom. That was a poster that they released to commemorate the World Rally Championship win in 1989.
That's awesome.
So that's proper provenance. So then you know, right, I'm going to Dartford on Thursday and I'm going to pick up a genuine car because you know, I'm confident in it.
I suppose that's another question I had. When you, do you look for cars that are kind of all together, already there, and you think, okay, this will just appreciate in value simply for the car it is and the time that it'll take to, you know, just over time it will go up. Or do you end up looking for cars that will need some work doing or restorations doing, and you think, okay, well, the investors, if they wanted to, they can vote on what they want to have done to the car to maybe appreciate the value. Is it, like, I would say they're two different things. Do you tend to look for cars that are fully ready or ones that are more, not projects not necessarily, that need full restorations, but maybe, say you bought the car that had multiple different colours and thinking, okay, this actually, even though it's going to cost maybe $5,000, I don't know how much paint jobs cost, $5,000 to get everything resprayed and sorted, but it will add on maybe $10,000 or $15,000 to the car. What kind of would you do in that situation?
At the moment, I think it's a journey. You know, we're just starting out. You know, we launched officially, if you like, October last year, although we've been going since October 19. You know, the actual sort of first car was on the platform in October 2020. So it's, you know, it's only been a 9-month journey so far, really. And we need to build credibility, I think, and to do a restoration type project is absolutely the place we want to get to. You know, I think that would be fantastic. And you know, we've been talking to Ant Partridge earlier about the potential of doing a TV based restoration. You know, where we crowdfund the resto, and actually, you know, we have somebody on telly that sort of manages it, so that the investors can actually see and feel really part of that journey and that experience, because they own a real share in the car that's being modified or that's being customized or being restored. But I think we need to have a foundation of delivering good returns on investments, of being credible, you know, of being a trusted brand, if you like. And I think that comes with bringing cars to the platform that are already sorted, that it's an easier decision to go, I'm going to have a share of that and see how it goes over the next 6 months to a year. I mean, our ultimate aim is to get to being, you know, a crowdfunding platform that allows people to own their own F1 team. Or something like that. Why not, right? You know, we can do X million shares. Doesn't matter to us how many shares. And you know, if you could be part owner of an F1 team, we could at some point maybe have the first publicly funded F1 team. That's the dream. You know? But that's the versatility of the platform. So, absolutely. In the future, there's lots of cool ideas and cool things to come. But I think we have to start with the right foundation, build the credibility as a good finance business that treats the customers right, that generates the returns, and then we can move into some of the sort of quirkier stuff.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I've got loads of questions, but I don't want to like keep asking questions.
No, I'd like you to. Go for it.
I feel like I could carry on asking questions.
Go for it. It's yours.
Okay, next question. How long do you ever think to yourself, okay, I will buy X car, and in your mind, you think, okay, I'm going to try and keep it for at least 5 years or 10 years, or How do you know at what point upon buying that you could have a return on that investment? Or is it something you just think at some point in the future? For example, the Lotus Emira, the last petrol engine that Lotus are going to produce, and probably maybe one of the last ever.
Yeah.
Obviously, they are high price at the moment. In I don't know how many years they may be dipped as people start to get them on the market or whatever. And then at some point, I imagine they'll go back up again. I don't know, Carl. Things. So I don't know when you'd think about buying one. Or maybe you do buy one now and then you keep hold of it. How long do you envision yourselves holding on to those cars before they... And you think about letting them kind of,
It depends on the, it's going through that criteria again, really, and sort of seeing what you're buying the car for. I mean, rather than the Emira, I think I'd probably buy the TVR Griffith that's going to be coming out, similar rival, a bit cheaper. Mm. And TVR have had such a checkered history, even more than Lotus, I think, in terms of, it's not the racing pedigree side, but in terms of just the brute force cars that they've produced. That having a Griffith and just keeping that with delivery mileage, because I'm pretty sure that they probably won't last much longer than that one model, maybe. I mean, I'm sorry to the owners of it. I hope you do believe me. But if it doesn't, that could be a real special one, as opposed to the Emira. Yeah, it's the last petrol one they've done, but Lotus have done a lot of good sports cars. Mm. So, it's one of a lot more. And it's just trying to find that needle in the haystack type thing. I think if you're looking for a new car, same as like the RS 4.4 litre 997 that Porsche did, it was such a rare car. And then if you can get a painter sample version of that, which is even rarer, you're looking at £400,000-£500,000 for one of those. Because it is just much more limited numbers. So some cars almost instantly will go up in value if it is a real limited thing. Others, as we've gone through the criteria, like for example the Clio V6, it's kind of, it's already started on its appreciation curve when we bought ours. I mean, there's more than it was new at 30K almost. But the fact that we know it's going to go to America, I think, ours is, 2003 car. So when it gets to 2028, which sounds like a long way off, 7 years. Mm. But as soon as you get to about 20 years old, 21 years old, the dealers start to buy them up, ready to ship to North America. And that's when the prices start to really increase. So I think with that one, you're looking at 3, maybe 4 years. And actually, the numbers would have really gone up a lot more. For everything else, if we're looking at more of a teen poster car, it's when the people hit 40 years old. So you've got to make sure the car's about 25, 30 years old. And then we look to sell it on for those sort of poster cars of people's, our generations, kind of poster cars. So it really, as you go through the criteria, really, I think you can kind of almost earmark how you think the appreciation curve will work for that vehicle. And that's something that we sort of spell out in our PDF investor packs to say, like, this is a much longer term thing, or at the moment we're looking at 3 to 5 years for everything we're bringing on.
Yeah.
So. Do you think you'll get to the point where you consider buying new stuff, like trying to get on that, let's say, Porsche GT3 wave? I know that a lot of manufacturers are now being super careful.
Yeah, they are,
Porsche,
yeah.
If Porsche catch wind of you getting an allocation with the intention of selling it, and then that's it, you're blacklisted.
You'll never buy a Porsche again. I've heard lots of people.
Yeah. Ferrari do a very similar thing. And I have to say, I agree with it, because I think there are a lot of people out there. A very good friend of mine, Phil, went into Porsche many years ago. So this would have been for the 991 iteration of the GT3. Now, Phil is a track day driver. He's the owner of a company that specializes in drifting. He's the epitome of somebody that enjoys driving a car for the purpose that it was designed for. He went into Porsche to try and buy a car, and they wouldn't sell him one because they couldn't. The allocation just wasn't there. He hadn't bought enough previous Porsches.
Yep.
And all he wanted to do was buy a GT3 to drive a GT3 on track days. And of course, everybody else that went into the showroom that had bought 16 Macans the previous year and a Cayenne and
four 911s just two to around in their Chelsea tracks.
Exactly. Yeah. They're the ones that go and buy them. But anyway, that's by the by. I wonder if you'll get to the point where, rather than having just the classic stuff, if you'll look at going, right, that's possibly an allocation that GR Yaris is a perfect example. There are dealers. I went onto a forecourt a couple of weeks ago. There was a dealer there that was quite happily listing his GR Yaris that he'd bought personally for himself for £41,000.
And he'd sell it.
And it's going to sell.
It's going to sell.
It's going to sell. Do you think you'll dabble in that, or do you think that's a bit too kind of short-term high risk?
Yeah, I think at the moment, it goes back to the point, I think, from before, where it's about building the credibility first. I think for us to do a new one like that at the moment would perhaps be a bit too short-term high risk. Although, the TVR Griffith is one that I am very interested. I've said it a couple of times, but I think it's an interesting one.
We've never really talked about TVR on the podcast, which is an interesting one. And this, I feel like this new chapter of TVR has been going on now for about 4 years.
Yeah.
I can't trust it. And I'm like, but that's
the beauty of why, from an investment perspective, if they do manage to do it and you get one of the first ones off, it might even be like mid-production run. It might just stop. You know, that's why Spyker, we love the Spyker, it's so interesting because they've had, you know, from making the most amount of cars of anybody at the turn of the 1900s and having the most model numbers, even more than Mercedes-Benz and everybody else.
Yeah.
They you know, they went bust in 1940 and then you know, they've been resurrected just for a short period where they made the Spyker C8 and came third in Le Mans, owned a Formula One team, you know, did all these amazing things and then went bust. And then they've been resurrected like five times since.
Yeah.
It's never quite made it to production. But that just keeps the C8 value that has been produced. You know, the values just keep climbing because they're still popular, still in the news. They were just about the Phoenix from the flames and then not, which kind of makes the models that have been produced even more valuable. So that's why the CVR, I just think there's something about it that if it does get made, having one of those, and then, you know, I can't imagine they're going to start producing sports car after sports car after sports car.
No.
It might be something that becomes a bit of a needle in a haystack in a few years' time.
Do you think it will get made? Because I've got a bit of a tarnished view of TVR because I know one of the board members fairly well.
Oh, you might have some inside knowledge there. In no insider trading allowed.
We'll keep it legal. I still can't work out if it's actually going to happen. And if it does, if people are actually going to buy it now. Because I remember the launch or the announcement of we're making the new car and we're taking deposits. And they got loads. They got inundated.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely hundreds of people, if not thousands of people, were throwing whatever it was, 500 quid, as a yes, I'm interested, put me down. And then they launched the car, I think, at the Revival, Goodwood Revival, a few years ago. They did that lovely miniature Earl's Court mock-up and they had the car in there. And it was an opportunity for all those initial putter downers to go in and go, right, here's the car, this is the one you're going to buy. And about 45% of the people that put their deposit down went, can I have my money back, please?
Yeah.
I don't want it. I don't like it. And of course, there were a series of errors. They like the official press release launch photos they did, for whatever reason, they photographed the car in a beautiful, maybe beautiful, but not the right word, but in an industrial looking workshop and environment, which would have been a really cool photo shoot. But what they decided to do was just superimpose a load of grey backgrounds.
Yeah.
It just looked rubbish.
Yeah.
You could see in the reflection of the windows, there was actually quite a cool setting that would have worked really well for a company that was kind of famous for its industrial feel and raw and raucous feel. And suddenly it's in this weird fake grey box and everyone just kind of went, what are you doing?
Like, yeah, they've definitely made a few mistakes, I think, with it. But they are taking customers' money more now as well. I don't know. I don't know if it'll be produced. I just think that is, like, the Lotus definitely will be produced. And it is going to be a very successful and a very good car.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just think there's something, again, it goes back to the short-term high risk, right? So it's probably not going to be one for us, but it's something that just, there's a bit of an itch there that I just think if they can make that, you know, I grew up with watching Swordfish with Halle Berry and John Travolta and the Tuscan S with the flip paint.
You
just think, they're just nuts cars. And it's just something that lives in your memory, you know.
Completely.
And I just think if they can do, and they've just perpetually started and stopped since then. And if you can do something, if that brand can come back, I just think it carries so much weight.
I don't think there is a petrol head in the entire country, in the UK. Obviously we have many hundreds of thousands of listeners all over the world, but for us Brits, if you're a car fan, you want to see TVR succeed because it is mad. It's a mad brand. It is. And as you say, you know, the cars are always purple and blue but green at the same time. I have fond memories of being about, I must have been about 12 or 13, and my grandfather's next door neighbor had a TVR Tuscan delivered, and it came on a TVR truck.
Oh.
And all the neighbours came out to watch this car, and it was a spaceship.
It was a spaceship
rolling out of a lorry, and we're all like, wow. And he subsequently crashed it about 3 weeks later, because of course it was an absolute handful to drive. But it's one of these cars where you cannot help but go, oh, look, TVR.
Yeah,
horse races. It's so memorable, and especially I think in our, we're all roughly the same age, in our age group as well, we all have a story about a TVR or something that we remember because they are so memorable. I think, you know, even well before I was into cars, I would call them alien cars because they just the way they looked. My first experience with the one was quite funny, was I got taken to my first prom at the age of about 14, 15 years old in a TVR. But my dad had to follow because they didn't know if it was going to make it.
Yeah, you have to have a pace car.
In his
support vehicle.
I know. But as you said, it is something I think is, it is looking for those things that are iconic, not necessarily just in terms of the important, interesting ones, but also what are the poster cars of people today, for example, or for people that were maybe 5 years ago or something, just trying to think forward of trends that you think may happen with as much research as you can possibly manage.
That's a great point. And that's exactly where I think, again, going back to that point, once we've proven the concept, I think, and we've got, you know, like a nice audience, a big audience, you know, we're asking the audience all the time to recommend what they think as well, you know, via Instagram and via the emails and stuff. You know, we get lots of people saying, can you buy this? Can you buy that? And actually, you know, you're absolutely right. Looking at the poster cards of the people that are a few years away, or things like the Series 1 Lotus Elise that's just starting to sort of creep up in values. You're getting on the train a bit earlier, so you can really get them at the bottom of the market, like a Saxo VTS, for example. You know, at the moment, they're sort of £3,000 or £4,000 if you can find one. You know, that you know, is another hot hatch aspect that we think, you know, will go really well. Because although my hot hatches were the 205 GTI and the Renault 5s and all that sort of stuff that are already close to the late teens into the 20s, something like the Saxo is going to be the generation behind me's one, you know, and it's sort of trying to sort of, I guess, again, goes back to the heart head thing. It's not the heart that buying that, it's the head that's going to buy those, because they will be the ones that will be the next investment ones.
I want to delve into that a little bit, because again, this is a great way to kind of find out car personalities. This is good car pub chat. I like to find. Do you have, what is that car for you, if any? I know you mentioned things like Saxo, but is there a car that, and it doesn't have to be an attainable one. Like for me, I've got very fond memories of my dad, who used to be a Snap-on man. He used to be that drove around in a Snap-on tool van.
Yeah, yeah.
And occasionally they would give away, if you bought a certain number of tools or a toolbox, you would get like a toy or a model. And they partnered with, is it Burago that make those like scale model cars?
Oh, yeah. I know you mean, yeah.
I might have pronounced that completely wrong.
I
remember Dad coming home one day with two models and saying, right, you know, you've got excess of these. And one was an F40 and one was a 550 Maranello. And there was something about the 550 Maranello that just, it set something off in my brain. And it might have been just the case that it sat beside my bed for years, or it sat on a shelf for years. And I just loved the way it looked, and I loved the shapes and everything about it. And even now, if a 550 Maranello pulls up in the car park now, you will lose me for about 30 seconds, because it's just, it becomes this iconic thing. And that for me is one of my tick list cars. If I can, if I have the means, I will buy a 550 Maranello for no real reason beyond the fact that a model was brought home one day and I just adored it.
Yeah.
Do you have anything like that?
Yeah. I mean, I mean, the memories for me really is rallycross, you know. I think and the RAC rally as well. So all the Group B stuff. I mean, you know, Lancia Delta Integrales, Metro 6R4s, you know, RS 200, anything that was just spitting flames through the forests, you know, Audi S1s. I just remember the noise, you know, just the noise and that feeling. I'm getting goosebumps now just talking about it.
Yeah.
Just that thrill as being like a 5 or 6 year old, up to that was about 11 or 12, my dad taking me to Lynn Hill or to Brands Hatch or any of the big rallycross circuits, and you see Martin Shanker against Will Gollop, and I was just in it, you know, I was just in it. We had a little rallycross mini, a little 1275 rallycross mini that I used to work on. My first job was the long screwdriver to scrape the bud off. And then, you know, later on, you know, I was getting seriously involved in sort of the mechanical side of it as well, and helping out with my dad, who was doing most of the mechanics on it. So it just became kind of in our blood. So anything in that era definitely is there. And then I guess from a road going perspective, I've always loved Ferraris. I was lucky enough, one of our friends was a race mechanic for Williams.
Right.
For the Formula One team. So he was actually the head of logistics, but he used to be in the pit lane. And the guy's just going back into probably the early to mid 90s. So it was Patrese and Mansell that were driving the Williams number 5 and 6. And he was working for Benetton, because he was working for Roberto Moreno, who was driving for Benetton at the time. So we were in the Benetton garage, but I love Ferrari, so I had a Ferrari coat on and a Pirelli hat because they were the tyre supplier. So when I went into the Benetton garage, even though there was no social media in those days, there were still the TV cameras, so they had to put duct tape over my hat and duct tape over my chest. So there's these shots of archive footage showing BBC of this like small 10-year-old boy stood in a Ferrari jacket with a black duct tape all over him, wrapped up in duct tape. And you know, I just say, I mean, I've been lucky enough to be in a few really cool, I guess, sporting and motor racing you know, events and occasions, which has just made it literally be through my blood. And you know, right through into when I was like 14 or 15, my dad started to buy and sell cars, and I started to collect data and spreadsheets about what cars were doing well and up and down in value. And
it's like the books you used
it's
to
almost
have,
like a little black book.
Yeah, where you have a little tick list of things that you've seen,
and just to sort of earmarking those and going to various auctions and like writing down the prices and those sorts of things. It's just a real geeky sort of thing that's been in my blood. But I definitely have to say, from a first kind of car perspective, when I was down at South End Seafront and that with the you know, where you get the cruises, we used to put the You just put the tea trays in the under the back wheels of the front wheel drive cars because they do donuts and things like that. Stupid, stupid, silly, irreversible behaviour. Don't do
yes,
that.
Yes, we don't endorse that.
Don't condone that sort of behaviour. But when we used to do that, and I used to see the Nissan GTIR, the Sunny, the Pulsars mainly, but they used to fly up and down and beat the RS turbos and all sorts. Mm. And that was the car for me that was like, I've got to, at some point, you know, I need to scratch that itch. So when I found this one in the garage, although it's not an investment grade vehicle because it's been written off in 1996, so we could never do it as an investment car.
Sure.
I just fell in love and I was like, you know, it's a white original Nissan Sunny. I've got to have that and see what it's like to drive it because I never got the chance when I was 19. And again, to get the goosebumps just driving that over today.
It's funny, isn't it? Because there's a lot of people that will look at a car of that age and certainly for the younger people that are younger than us, they might look at it and not really get it.
Oh, it looks horrible.
It's one extreme or the other. They're going to look at it and go, oh, wow, that's amazing. Or they're going to go, what's that? A prime example of this. So I got invited by the lovely people at the SL shop, which is a workshop not far from Café de Machine, actually, that specialise in just classic Mercedes SLs. And they were doing a celebration of the R107, so the 1970s to 1980s SL shape.
I love that one, yeah.
Me too, because for me, I was born in 87, and as a child, that would be a car that you'd see driving around quite a lot on the road. You'd be like, oh, that's quite a cool looking convertible thing. And so when Sam and the guys at the SL shop invited me along for this day, I thought, oh, that'd be really good fun. And I sent a photo of it to a couple of friends and just said, oh, this is what I'm driving today. And one of them's a massive petrol head, one of them's not. And the petrol head was like, oh, cool, love an R107. Like, that's awesome. Really like the simplicity of the 1970s and 80s dash. And the other friend said, that's just an old banger. And you think, what? You know, because those cars are selling for like 45, 50 grand now.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
If you've gone out and bought a 45, 50 grand car, you'd like to think, you know, I've bought something.
Someone would think it's an old banger.
Somebody out there is going to look at it and go, that's an old banger.
Well, yeah, that's somebody with my wife the other day. When I pulled that out and washed it down, I was really proud of myself because I got some flat white paint gleaming that hadn't moved since 2008. So I was really pleased with my detailing skills, which aren't the best. And she comes back and goes, what the hell is that? What the hell is that? It's a Nissan Sunny. So Nissan Sunny? Not only that, it's nearly a 30-year-old Nissan Sunny. That, but yeah, for me, it's like, it's absolutely, you know, just evokes all these memories. But yeah, I mean, it's a square boxy looking thing, but it's just got a snarly dash and it's just, you know, it's got the 2-litre turbocharged engine in that just, yeah, makes all the right noises for me and it's great. But yeah, I mean, it's probably £20,000-£25,000, even though it's been written off before. You know, it's amazing how much they fetch.
It is crazy, isn't it? And especially when you think back, there's that era, that horrible era where we all look back on, it's only something you can do now in hindsight where you realise just how cheap things were.
No, of course.
And
of course.
Again, the regular podcast listeners will know this and they'll start rolling their eyes immediately as soon as I start talking about it. But I am a bit of a BMW M fanatic.
Oh, yes.
I have no idea, John.
have I not mentioned this before?
I've not heard this one.
Oh, well, let me tell you right now. No, so mid-90s to mid-noughties, anything with a BMW M badge for me is just, I want them all. At some point, I want every single M car.
That'd be great, wouldn't it? Like that poster.
Produced. Yeah, exactly.
From the E30. Will you go into,
that's what I'd want.
Will you go into your garage and just go,
Yeah, it'll be the M garage. the M garage on the side of my M house.
You can see the Instagram and YouTube channel now. Yeah.
And of course, there are things like, there are certain cars that I skipped. I got the E46 M3 and I made some money on it. That was brilliant. I do massively regret selling it, but made some money on that.
Yeah.
And then I remember at the time of selling that E36 M3, so we're talking the mid-1990s to late 1990s shape of M3, they were, and it makes me feel sick to say it, they were about £3,000 to £4,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And I even had the money in the bank. And I thought, maybe I should just buy one of these. But because it was kind of that controversial M3, because it was the M3 made by the marketing department as opposed to the motorsport department, there were certain people that said, oh, you know, it's never going to be big money. And of course, they're now selling for 10, minimum 10.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly 15, yeah. Some over 20. And you think, bugger. that was only really 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, but that's the chat. I mean, that's exactly why we started the business. You know, that's exactly the reason, you know, almost to because everybody has those conversations, but life gets in the way. You know, I've been lucky enough to have a few cars, personal cars, that have done okay. But I would love to have had, you know, 10 or 15, because I kind of knew which ones they were going to be, but you just can't buy them all. You haven't got the space, you haven't got the time, you haven't got the money, you know, and it's really difficult. But if you can be down the pub with the mates and be like, right, well, I think an RS Turbo, an XR2, a Sierra Cosworth, you know, I want a Renault 5. I want, you know, you can pick the 10 cars, the Audi TT, R8, whatever you want. And you can pick those and you know, now you can have one or two or more shares in those and spread your risk across all of them and you know, have your own kind of personal garage and feel like you've got a stake in all these different cars so that you're not just saying, oh God, you see how much those things are fetching? I could have had one of them in 4 years ago. You're actually saying, well, I've got a share in one of them that I bought 4 years ago that's now I've got part of that appreciation. Mm. So we're hoping to almost help the petrolheads be a bit more savvy with it and actually, you know, help to get a bit of return on investment for their passion. You know, that's the big thing, really.
I suppose the interesting thing at the moment I've only just thought about is that when you started this in October 2019.
Yeah, that's when we first, the limited company, yeah.
At the minute, you're accumulating the cars and the shares, but have you yet sold on anything yet?
Not yet. So we fully funded the Peugeot 205 GTI. So that was a 24,000-mile one official owner of a DVLA car that we managed to find. I mean, that's absolutely immaculate. That was 18,000 sort of funded at. And sort of recent valuation at just around 20,000. So the valuation has already crept up, you know, sort of 10% in that within about 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then the Clio, you know, it's a 30,000 pound, so it's £30 a share. We've got about 150 shares left. But the valuation of that Clio, if you look at the value of collecting cars, the last, I think it's 9 V6s that have sold phase ones on collecting cars over the last 12 months, the average value is 38 grand.
Got it. So would then you then put up the, sorry, I'm jumping the gun a bit here. You then go in, if you're going to sell the car, do you think to yourself, all right, for the last however long on the average cost has been selling it for this amount, do you then go to sell a car, or will you go to sell a car on auction or privately, or like will you find a buyer, and kind of go for that average cost? Or how do you figure out your valuation?
Yeah, well, the valuations are done. So, yeah, it's two parts. Now, the valuations are done depending on the type of car, either via using data from the market or glenmarch.com. So that's the sort of two places where all of the sales are logged via auction houses and private sales. And we tend to get quite a lot of good data points for the more, mainstream cars, like your Clio V6s or your Ferraris. And then we've also got a membership with the Historical Automobile Group Index for the more rare stuff. So the things that are only sold maybe twice a year or something. So it's, and they're often private sales as well. So Haggy sort of do an index on the valuations of those types of cars, which helps us to value those. So there's a bit of science that goes into the valuations. But we'll also look at, you know, just general trends in the market in terms of things like collecting cars that we've done for the Clio as well. Give an indication. But in terms of selling the car, we don't decide when to sell the car, so we're not a fund. You know, we don't have any we don't control the company. The company that owns the car outright is controlled fully by the shareholders. So as a shareholder, it's one share, one vote, and you get to vote twice a year as to whether you want to keep the car or sell the car. And it's the group of shareholders that have clubbed together to buy that car in the first place that therefore decide when to sell that car as well. So it's a democracy, you know, as long as there's, I think, more than about 15% has to be to make it a valid vote. And then it's just a democracy in terms of whether it sells. We will then try and aim to sell the car at the latest valuation. Obviously, that's sort of the aim. And we always be conservative with the valuations because the last thing we want to do as an investment business is disappoint and, you know, overpromise and underdeliver. Yeah. So the plan would be usually probably to use businesses like the market, collecting cars, trade classics, etc. There's quite a lot of plethora of you know, really good auction websites that have come out that have got good publicity that get good return in terms of selling sort of modern classics and appreciating classics. Or if it's a really good car, we also have, you know, distribution via dealerships as well that we know and that we've worked with in the past that could just put it up onto the dealership website and obviously try and return the investment that way. And the final route of sale is one of the investors likes it so much they want to buy the whole thing.
I was going to say, of course, there'll be somebody in there that perhaps has got investments in not just Car Crowd, but other bits and pieces. And if something big comes in, they go, actually, I really want that car now.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess people build up a relationship, even if the closest you ever get is one of your cars and coffee days and you go along and have a look, there will be something that, you know, triggers some sort of emotion in one of those investors that goes, oh, actually, I've grown to quite like this thing now and it needs to be mine.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, people, we've got one of the guys who's invested in the Peugeot. He's bought shares in the Peugeot because he got married. He got the car he was driven to for his wedding.
Oh, wow.
And he's, you know, he can't afford to buy the whole car back again, but he wants to feel part of it. He's come to the unit a couple of times to see it with his wife and stuff. And it's like, that's a great story. Yeah. And we give him access to that. Whereas we've got other people that have come to the unit to take photographs with some of the cars where they want to put it on their Tinder profile because they're more younger millennials and they want to feel like they've got a car collection. And that's fine too. You know, we don't mind.
I suppose they could say, I do own.
And I do own technically a very small part.
Yeah, a very small part of this car.
But yeah, I mean, so there's you know, there's sort of horses for courses, really. But again, it's just about the access. It's just about feeling closer to something that you really care about and being able to invest in something you're knowledgeable about. Yeah. You know, that has to kind of be a good thing.
Amy, I see you've got a list of things. Have you worked through?
I'm just seeing if I've gone through my entire list. Hang on. I suppose a lot of it's been answered in a lot of our chats. Like, for example, I wanted to ask about the idea of, yourself, is this purely investment or is it passionate? We've worked out that it's purely
definitely passion. Yeah.
I suppose that's the thing about when you do want to invest in, we've always talked about in many of the podcasts, the idea of when you buy, especially a classic car. I mean, we've always said to buy what your heart tells you to buy, because things will go wrong. It may go up, it may go down. Yeah, and you just have to do it purely because you like that car. And then if it goes up, great. I think especially with classic cars, generally you kind of stay in the middle. You may go up, but it's very up and down. So yeah. The idea of trying to buy with your head, I think personally I'd like it's fascinating to hear about all the ways that you're researching and the places that you're thinking, okay, what about this trend, do we think this is going to happen, or about trying to find your more rare things, and just the amount of research you must do, the time to be able to try and figure this out scientifically, I guess, more than anything, because it is, as you said, something that's more had to be led with your head rather than your heart.
It's
that must be where a lot of your time is spent, literally just researching all these things.
I mean, since my wife's now, we're now a husband and wife team, so my wife's come on board as the chief marketing officer for us, and since she's come on board, she's freed me up a lot more to be able to do a lot more of that, and that's why we're now bringing the next wave of cars on. So the Sierra Cosworth that we sort of found, the Renault 5, and then the Ferrari 360 and the Spyker. So we've got a nice range of kind of from sort of 20 odd pounds up to £220. And that was a long time. As I say, kiss a few frogs and a lot of research, a lot of trawling for adverts, contacting owners clubs, talking to a lot of people, trying to find, and it's just been nice, it's great. Petrolheads want to talk to other petrolheads, but I think if you're, not being antagonistic and saying, well, it's not the right model, just trying to point out flaws. If you're a nice person, that's the way I try to approach it, is to try and generate friendships almost with a lot of these people, because it might not be that car, but it might be another car they might have or that they found that they could recommend for us. And as soon as you get into that market, I think, of people understanding and knowing that that you've got a route, an outlet for them to be able to potentially sell a car or move a car on, you get offered some great stuff, some weird stuff, and some comes from all sorts of different places. And I'm finding now that it's easier because we've got that scientific approach a bit in the criteria. It's quite easy to tick ones that we don't want, and say, actually, no, that's not right, and have kind of our shortlist of the ones that we're sort of looking for.
I don't know if this is going to be a difficult question or not now. Going from the scientific view, and there must be other people, other companies doing a similar thing to yourself and around the world. And if you're all following the basic scientific point, would you think they'll get to a point in the point of selling the vehicle where you've all got on the scientific trends, bought similar vehicles to sell at roughly the same time, that would that end up saturating the market and therefore devaluing the car?
Well, I think if you're looking globally, no, because globally we're lucky to have very different cultures, really, in terms of the cars that we love. Rally Road, who do this similar, very similar thing. The only other company to us in the world who do a similar thing is Rally Road in the US. But they're
don't talk about
that. They're okay. But if you're British, you can't buy shares in there. That's kind of one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it over here, because I was working in America at the time and I wanted to buy a share in a Ferrari they had, 550 actually. And I couldn't because I wasn't an American citizen. So that's one of the reasons why I thought, actually, that idea is so cool. I want to see if I can do it in the UK. The UK trends and the UK types of vehicles are very different to what the US like. Trucks and Mustangs and V8s and, NASCAR type influence vehicles are much more, I guess, iconic for those guys over there, whereas where the hot hatches and the Ford Badger and that sort of stuff is much more iconic for us. So I think I don't think there's a risk of the global businesses kind of buying the same cars and trying to sell them at the same time too much. I mean, and in the UK, we're currently, as far as we're aware, the only business that are doing, fraction investments in cars. There may be other companies that come on board and do it as well. And yes, there may be competition, but I think it'll only help, because these cars will come kind of out of people's garages and sheds where they're stored and no one knows about them into the light where people actually do know and appreciate them. I think there's always going to be a ceiling for every car in terms of where it can get to. And because we're trying to buy quite rare and quite iconic ones, I think it's no different to what happens at the moment. You get somebody who starts selling one at one price and it goes up and up and up, and the dealerships kind of already push them up. And then everyone gets them out. That happened with the E-types a few years ago. Like everyone just got them out of their garages and it's like, well, I've got an E-type, I'll sell mine. And all of a sudden the price went to the top and then it started to sort of come down again. So I don't think there's a risk of us, because we're not buying thousands of cars, you know, we're talking two, maybe three cars, hopefully a month by the time we get to scale. I don't think there's a risk of us saturating or flooding a market and falsifying a price, if that makes sense. And because we're buying very different cars, you know, we're not buying all the Ferraris or all the Lamborghinis. It's going to be very spread. So I think our portfolio, if you like, will kind of hopefully all appreciate together, but they, you know, they won't dictate a market.
Yeah, I suppose, at least from a business point of view, there's no point in you buying things that you don't have faith in yourselves to
absolutely
be able to think
no.
this is going to work.
And we have to, you know, we really want to be sort about diversification as well. You know, we wouldn't want to just buy, you know, one mark or one type of vehicle. Although if someone offered us, you know, five McLaren F1s, £1 million each, we'd take it, but who wouldn't?
I would exactly. find some money to help with that. I'd sell terrible things and services.
I'm not sure how much money you'd get there, John.
True. Got to know your market. So let's run through some of the cars that you've got before we wrap things up.
Yeah.
Because there will be people at home thinking, I'm sure, going, right, this sounds like something I want to get involved in. But what have you got? So run us through what you've got and perhaps even some of the wish list as well.
I was going to ask about the wish list as
well. Because they might, you never know. We have an awful lot of listeners now. There might be somebody sat at home with a lot of cars that they're going, oh, do you know, I could probably get rid of that E-type or whatever they've got cluttering the garage.
Yeah.
And what have you got in at the moment? And what is it you're hoping to get that maybe one of our listeners might be able to sell you?
Okay. So, I mean, what we've got, so we funded the Peugeot, as I say, the 205. The Clio V6 is, I think, as I say, like 90% funded. So it's about 10% of the shares left at that, £30. They were the first two cars. And then we're adding four cars onto the platform. Literally the Ferrari 360 Modena, 22,000 mile, one owner, and again, we talked about spec before. It's a right-hand drive. It's a manual. Perfect. It's an original UK car. It's Rosso red. It's creamer interior. So, you know, it ticks all the boxes. It's got the original battery charger, original toolkit. You know, it has to tick all the boxes for us to bring it to the platform. And this one really did. It's three owners. And I think it's got pretty much Ferrari Owners Club. And I think there's 14 service stamps pretty much all the way through, double cam belt change, etc. So very well-maintained, fastidiously maintained car. And that will come to the platform for about £77 a share. Mm-hmm. That'll be live in the next week or so. The Spyker C8, that's our kind of, I guess, the hero car, if you like. So one of eight in the world, right-hand drive Spyker C8 convertibles. And if you don't know much about the Spyker brand, just Google it or go to the Spyker website and just read their history page, because they have just such a fascinating history from, as I say, building motor cars and aeroplanes. And you can just see it coming through into the 2000s, the C8 that they built in the 2000s. Ours was the Le Mans. Ours was the car that was in the Le Mans showroom. Mm-hmm. Sat there for 4 years, and then it was sold on in 2007. So it's 2003 build. So it's got the original propeller steering wheel, but it was released in 2007. 13,000 miles, I think, from new. Again, you know, really well looked after and maintained. That'll be live again in the next week. And then the two that I'm most excited about, because they're just in my blood, are the Renault 5 GT Turbo Raider Edition.
Right.
So the Aaron Auriel, as it was called in France, but became a Raider over here, because I don't think the Brits could pronounce Aaron Auriel. he won the Rally World Championship in 89, I think. And I think that was the sort of homologations poster car that was released to celebrate the win that he did at the Rally Championship. Then, you know, that was limited to a few hundred units that were sold here in the UK. So again, quite a rare car. 43,000 miles, two owners or two or three owners, but low ownership, you know. And again, I mean, this is the guy who sent me 270 pictures of the history. I mean, it's ridiculous. He's got everything. We're picking that up on Thursday. So that'll be conditioned and then photographed and put onto the platform sometime in early August. Mm-hmm. And then the final one to come is the Sierra, three-door Sierra RS Cosworth, which I think is everybody's, or a lot of people, poster car.
Excellent.
I mean, the numbers they're fetching already ridiculous, but we've managed to find one for a really, really good price. It was actually the car that Tiffany Dell drove on Top Gear.
Oh, cool.
When he was comparing it to the RS500. UK car, two owners, 43,000 miles, you know, absolutely mint. All original apart from a stainless steel exhaust been changed, and it's had an 8.5 grand paint job, a respray.
Right.
Which we would obviously love to have original paint, but actually, you know, if it's just the respray, that's the one thing we can go
with. Yeah, and if it's been done well.
And it's been done amazingly well, yeah. So that's coming on, and that's going to be on the platform for, we're not exactly sure, but somewhere in the 60s, which is a pretty good number for a three-door Sierra Cosworth. And we've got some, we did some hard work finding that one, so we're quite pleased with that. And then wish list-wise, I think the next one I'd love to get is a Porsche of some sort. I think a 996, probably C4S or Turbo. Cool. Or GT3, but you know, GT3 is pushing the numbers up a little bit. I think the C4S is probably the one I'd have. Turbo bodied, you know, iconic, yeah, nice rear end bodies, with the big, yeah, big red light across the back. Find a low mileage, you know, sort of somewhere in the region of the 20 to 30,000 mile. One of those, if anyone's got one they want to sell us, that would be please get in touch. So I think that's probably the next one on the wish list. And then sort of BMW and VW, another two marks that we've not, you know, encountered and done too much. And then a Japanese car as well. So Mitsubishi Evo, probably 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Again, the Mitsubishi Evo is another one that wasn't released in the US until Evo 7.
Yeah.
So, you know, finding a 5 or 6 that hasn't been cut so far in North America would be a good one. And that could open up the market. We're too late for things like the Skylines, which have, you know, already,
I was
going to
say, actually, yeah, things like R32, R33 and R34s, yeah, which, yeah, are kind of getting into that now, can go to the US, yeah, as soon as that. I think the R34 you now can import.
Yeah, you can now. Yeah, just recently.
Only just.
Yeah,
only just, and that, recently, of course, yeah, made the values the go ones from 15,000 to sky's the limit.
Nearly 100K. I mean, yeah, you know, for a good low mileage one. You know, and people just will not sell them. And of course, the Fast and the Furious connection helps with that as well, exactly, from an iconic poster, exactly, car perspective. So yeah, I think the Skylines are probably, I mean, I'd love to have one, but I think, you know, it's not, that's going to be definitely a heart one rather than a head one. So yeah, probably won't. We'll probably avoid that. But yeah, something like a Mitsubishi Evo or a twin turbo Supra cool, would be really cool. And then the VW wise, yeah, I'm a golf man. I've had a few golfs, mm-hmm, in my time. I think probably the R32 is probably the one I'd quite like.
Yeah, nice.
Or maybe even just a nice Mark 5 GTI with the original Mark 1 seats with the, yep, checkered, mm-hmm, seats. Again, quite iconic. And what was I say? The BMW wise, yeah. I mean, yeah, you're the BMW man. What's the best,
yeah,
BMW man? I think the E90 with the V8 engines is probably the one I'd go for.
Do you know, it's funny, before we started recording this, I went and sorted myself out a t-shirt from the shop here at Cafe and Machine, because the one I was wearing was a bit wet because we sat up the truck in the pouring rain. And the guy in the shop said, who have you got on today on the podcast? And we were talking. I said, oh, it's, you know, it's a couple of people coming in to talk about making money from classic cars and investments. And he said to me, he asked that question. He said, what would you buy to make money?
Yeah.
And I just said, if you've got the money, for me, and this is not financial advice, ladies and gentlemen,
yeah,
but let me make that very clear. It's just my opinion on what I would do if I happen to find a spare £15,000 in my back pocket. I'd say anything manual gearbox, mid-90s to mid-noughties, E36, E46, E90, as you say, all of those M3 shapes. If you can find the budget to get a manual, or they were only manual, but an E39 M5.
Yes,
again,
yes.
This is a car that, again, I stupidly had the opportunity to buy only a few years ago. They were £4,000 or £5,000. You cannot find an E39 M5 now for less than 15.
What's the 200 mile an hour head-up display one? Was that the F?
That's the E60.
E60, is it right? Okay.
Blisteringly brilliant V10
yeah,
engine.
Yeah, V10 engine. That's another one that I think is a future.
That is a car I frequently go back to on classified ads, because for me, and if especially if you can get the touring, my God.
Oh, well, that's like Hens teeth, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's very rare to find.
Very rare. Yeah. But yeah, E60 M5, again, I just don't think you can go wrong. I think if you go and buy any of those now, my opinion is that they are all cars that have to go up in value. There are certain things to be aware of, things like the E60s. It is a motorsport-derived engine, and as a result of it, it is quite fragile,
yeah,
and it does require a lot of servicing, a lot of servicing. The fuel economy is eye-wateringly terrible, and for some reason, they put a fuel tank in approximately 2 pints of petrol.
Yeah, you can get more than 30 miles out, yeah, of it.
If you can get 200 miles out of an E60 V10 M5, then you're doing very well. So there are lots of things to consider. And again, it's about doing your own research, isn't it?
Or buying through someone like us where you don't have to worry about the storage or the maintenance, yeah, or anything like that. I mean, your driving experience is the bit you sacrifice, but you don't have the headaches, you know, as well.
No, that's right.
You can still get return investment.
That's exactly right.
And then from a supercar perspective, we're looking at manual R8, yeah, early manual R8 or early manual if you can find one, Gallardo or Diablo SV.
Yeah.
But very hard to find. I mean, I think Countaches and sort of Testarossas and things we're steering away from, because the maintenance is, you know, for ones that aren't driven and are, yeah, moved is catastrophic, or it can be catastrophic. So we want things that are a bit more modern, that you know, that sort of maintenance and storage aspect is a bit safer. So yeah, I mean, I think I'm quite excited about the R8. I think a manual R8 is a really good buy now, sort of 45K, somewhere in that region for a low mile one. That's a, you know, very, the first ones, the Mark ones, they're yeah, sort of really, yeah, really quite cool. And then from a Ferrari perspective, I'd still love to try and do a challenge car, you know, either the 360, yes, Challenge Stradale, somewhere in that would be amazing. A 550, 575 manual, if you can find a 575 manual, yeah, would be great.
Yeah.
It'll be very hard to come by. But there's, yeah, even the 599 GTOs now are sort of dipping below 100k as well.
That's true.
And they could be very good buys. So there's you know, there's, the thing is, this it's a great job to have because there's so many cars to sort of choose from and to try and look for. But yeah, that's why I say the heart kind of sometimes looks the rule, but trying to put the criteria behind it so the head brings it on. But any listeners, anybody who wants to recommend anything or send any suggestions in, you know, or has cars that they want to, you know, that might want to sell, then we're always interested to have a look, definitely.
Brilliant. Now, where can, because obviously people can get in contact with us. A lot of you, if you're a regular listener, you'll know that we have an email address and we love hearing from you. So feel free to email us podcast@drivenchat.com. Nice and easy to remember, podcast@drivenchat.com. Feel free to send in your car suggestions to us because, of course, we'd love to see them. We'll happily pass them on. But where can our listeners find you, David?
You can email us. We've got support@thecarcrowd.co.uk. So any car suggestions or anything like that, then let us know. Obviously, the website's just thecarcrowd.co.uk, nice and easy. And then we have Instagram, where thecarcrowduk on Instagram and Facebook. So check us out on social media, posting a lot of videos or photos. We're also going to be at the British Motor Show. Plug for those guys at the British Motor Show. Grab your tickets for that. That's on the 20th of August. I think it's going to be a really good show down in Farnborough. And we'll be at the NEC Classic Car Show as well, later on in the year in November.
Fantastic. So go and get your camel skin jackets on and your cigars out and try and sell David a car.
Yeah, absolutely. Come and find us. We'll chat cars for hours. I mean, we got into a ball bearing chat about the ball bearing turbos last time we were at the Classic Car Show. So, yeah.
Excellent.
Always up for that.
Amazing. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fascinating. This has certainly been a new one for us in the sense of a new way of potentially our listeners being able to invest and without having to spend loads and loads and loads of money. But of course, I think it's worth saying, you know, do your research, capital at risk and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, we do. Absolutely. Yeah, of course.
So, do check out the website. Do check out those social feeds. And if you've got something you want to shift to David, then drop us a line because we'll do our best and I'll maybe get a drink out of it.
Yeah, finder's fee, definitely. Yeah, no, thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Cheers.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you as well to the listener for joining us. And we will be back, surprise, surprise, next week with another guest, more stories and more fun. Same time next week. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Oh, wow. You've made it to the end. The very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven podcast in your preferred podcast app or head on over to the website driven.site to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.